Hey, everybody. Welcome to the cold open of this episode of Smart List. I'm freezing. You know, it'd be great if Arnett was here to warm this cold open up a little bit.
I don't think he's available.
No, he's not available.
No. We should just start. Let's just start.
Oh, God. Look at all these goozies on my arm. Welcome to Smart List. Smart.
Guess what I just finished watching moments ago?
A pizza pocket heat up in the microwave.
Oh, wait, now let me try.
I wish.
No, it's something with Scotty. I don't have it yet.
Your zipper on your pants not be able to close.
Oh, wait, I know what it is. It's the top button on your trousers flying across the room and breaking a light bulb.
No, I just watched the first, literally 10 minutes ago, finished watching DTF St. Louis, the first episode.
Let me tell you, it is so good.
It is right up my alley.
Is it?
And Jay, another incredible character by you.
Oh, thanks, man. Really, so different.
Really, quick question. Did you say it's a ride up your alley?
It's a ride up your alley. It's right up my alley.
He's been saying it wrong for years, Will. Don't stop him now.
No, it's right up my alley. The way it's shot and, of course, performed, you're brilliant. Yeah, it's so good, Jay.
I can't wait to see it. You're so good in it.
Writer, director.
I mean, that swing, incredible. Just the shot of the swing, that's all I'll say.
Yeah, I mean,
that's so smart. It's so cool.
It gets real crazy. It's
yeah,
really
and the ending of the first excited. Episode, wow. Yeah, it's
thank
really
you for
good.
Watching that, you sweet man.
It's so good. You're so good.
Do you? I don't know if I've ever admitted this on this show before, but speaking of saying things wrong for years.
Oh, shit.
And this is, I'll attribute this to not reading a lot. You know, I'm allergic to books, and I'm not proud of that.
Yeah.
Because I feel if I had seen this written, I wouldn't have made the mistake all these years. But I've always thought that when you say the phrase, I'm just trying to make ends meet, I thought that was a phrase that one would say when they're saying, listen, I'm just trying to get by with just the bare minimum. I'm not being greedy. I'm not entitled. I'm just trying to make ends meet, meaning I'm just looking for the part of the cow that doesn't cost a lot. I just need sustenance. I need some food. I'm looking for ends meet, like M-E-A-T, the end of the cow, the ass, which is not going to cost you a lot. This is what my stupid head.
This is what you're working on right now.
I'm 57, and this was probably a couple of years ago. I was 55 until I realized that it is ends of, you know, strings or whatever, creating a circle. You want these ends to meet and create a whole thing, and which can mean something similar to I'm just trying to make it all come together for myself.
You're trying to be able to afford stuff. You're trying to make ends meet. You're trying to do stuff within your budget.
It wasn't a proud moment for me, but I'm not beyond admitting my flaws.
Guys. I'm just trying to think of like the gotcha headlines in the various social media stuff about this.
This will be cut. No, this is just for you, me, and your guest, Will.
No, we can't cut this. Speaking of, what kind of cut is that at the end of the cow that you're talking about? You're talking about the flank steak.
Well, the flank is, it's often called the flank, where the
not,
end.
That's not the end.
The
that's
end wait, but you know, do you know that, like, I love, you know that. Remember that I love, like, sayings and their origination? What are
you
they called?
Stupid ass. Yeah.
This where is, they origin or originated from.
This is a
from.
Tough day for me. Go ahead.
And where they originated from, you know what I mean? And so remember I did the Saved by the Bell? I told you guys about Saved by the Bell.
Where you that did an episode? From. Or like an arc?
No, where that saying comes from.
Oh. Uh-huh,
remember the guy, people used to get buried. Remember I told you? Or they used to get buried alive. Uh-huh. And they didn't know it at the time because people like who were unconscious. They just thought they were dead. So they'd bury them in these coffins. Then they'd dig them back up to reuse the coffins. And they saw these scratch marks. So they're like, oh my God, we've been burying people alive. So they bury people alive. They tie a string to their toe. They put it through the ground and tie it to a bell. And you're saved by the bell if the bell goes off. And the person who had to sit there and wait to see if the bell went off worked the graveyard shift.
Wow.
Okay, and this is what you thought Saved by the Bell was for years.
No, that is what it is.
It's not. Evidently, it's a boxing thing.
Well, no. Evidently it originated with this, JB.
That's right.
Really?
We're learning.
Yes, that's what I'm telling you.
Wait, so hang on. So, Will, you're taking, that's news to you and you're going with Sean?
That's news to me. I do vaguely remember Sean mentioning this before.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't make it true. He's just repeating insanity.
Well, I mean, we can, I'm sure people could just look it up as they're listening to this right now. I don't know why we would.
That's where it comes from.
We're gonna have our fact checkers get on that while we're
fact checkers now?
Yeah, yeah. So let's have them do that. Will, go ahead, introduce your guest. And let's get on with it.
Oh, shoot. Jason.
This is a little runner that I've been having. Trying to get Will panicked
Did I ever get panicked about it?
No, I don't think it worked. It's my guest, and I'm so excited. And Willie, I think you're going to be excited too. I think it was you telling me that you're just a kooky fan for this fella, and I don't blame you because I am too. Gentlemen.
I'm not going to care.
No. No.
Great. Let's start.
It's going to be a great hour for you, Sean.
No, you will. Everybody freaks on this guy for very good reason. Have you searched for the answer to the age-old question, what should I do after pursuing rock stardom and being a lawyer? Our guest this week has the answer. You become one of the finest actors on the planet. You go out there, you work with the best directors in the world, you turn in some of the most powerful and moving performances ever, and then you grab yourself an armful of awards, including the little gold guy named Oscar. He's done 3 careers worth of work already in his 30 years of performing, and it's been theater and film and television, but one of those television projects is now a film, and he's here to talk to us about that. Gentlemen, please welcome Tommy Shelby himself, Mr. Killian Murphy.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
Here with us today.
Hi guys. How's it going?
Oh, Killian.
How cool. So nice to meet you.
Hey, man.
Nice to meet you. That was a lovely introduction. Thank you.
Right? I worked on it for minutes. what time is it for you today now?
It's like nearly 6 p.m. in London.
Oh, all right. Now, if you're like me, you're about an hour away from sleep. Are you in comfy socks? Are you getting ready to get horizontal, or are you about to start your night?
I do start thinking about bed from about 5:30. That is true.
Right? So we're keeping you up right now.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean I'm just thinking about it.
Yeah.
You know, but I will be approaching. I'll be in bed by like 9:30.
Right? Mm-hmm. You're good.
We're all in the same.
It's so nice.
I think the 4 of us are very good at relaxing and taking it easy. Now, is that because we're of a certain age, or is it because we've all really been good at getting after it and we're kind of done with that?
Yeah.
Right? I did it. Mm. And now I want to enjoy the relaxation of wisdom and age.
What do you guys think? What's your
feeling? I'm 100% agree with Jason, although I was going to ask you, Killian, is like I'm doing theater right now, and I know you've done a lot of theater, and it's like all of a sudden you have to retrain your brain to have the most energy at 8 p.m.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like of the whole day, you have to have most of your energy at 8 p.m. And it's rough.
Are you going on stage tonight?
And tomorrow, my quote-unquote week starts Wednesdays.
He's doing a one-man show, Killian. I think you've done one of those, haven't you?
I certainly have, Wow, yeah. Good that's man.
It's a lot.
That's like the fucking Everest of acting. That's what I call it.
It's pretty rough.
Well, Shawnee, I haven't asked you. I'll ask you both at the same time. Has there been a wipeout yet? Like a total, like, because that's my fear. Like, there's no net. There's no there's no actor you can find the eyes of and sort of communicate silently.
Right.
I have no idea what I'm supposed to say next. Throw me a line.
Yeah, my line the other night was, he tells me 2 kids came forward to confess to it. It was an accident. That's the line. And three or four shows ago, literally on stage, he tells
in a four-wheel slide.
Panic. It's just unbelievable. I mean, you feel like it's 20 minutes long. And I'd go, teenagers ran their car into him, killed him. And then I just started.
By the way, I'm sure the audience probably did not notice.
No, I know.
It seemed like interminable. Panic. Like, yeah.
But isn't the line you have forgotten linked to the line that follows it.
Yes,
and so you can't just improvise the line you can't remember, because that doesn't shine any light on the next thing you're supposed to say.
But you do know the kind of the context. You just kind of forget the word order. So then you paraphrase until you get back on the train.
Yeah, you get back.
So you got right back on and it was all right.
Yeah, it was fine. But
Killian, any nightmare like that?
Yeah.
You know the way when you're doing theater, it's like you got like the left hand side and the right hand. So you got the sort of stage manager side of your brain and you got the acting side of your brain, right? Mm-hmm. So you got the stage manager side going, right, you drop the prop back there. So you got to go back and pick up the prop while you're saying the lines.
That's right.
You know, they're acting similar. They're running parallel. So you got this kind of management in your head going, well, we got to fix this. And then the other side is talking.
Exactly
so
right.
I did probably, but I quite liked not having to rely on the terrified eyes across the stage to some other actor, uh-huh. like saying, can you pick up the fucking knife that was not supposed to? Yeah. So I quite enjoyed it. But what I did find, and I don't know about you, Sean, I could not sleep after it. I could not go to sleep.
It's been rough.
Really?
Yeah.
Just wired.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It was like being thrown out of a helicopter. I could not sleep.
How are you about the folks coming backstage and wanting to congratulate you and talk a little bit? Like, are you, I would imagine that I'm obsessed with this.
I know.
Because I don't want to be fucking bothered for the most part at any point in the day.
This will keep you from doing Broadway. This very thing will keep you from doing Broadway.
I'm with you though, Jay.
But I
I'm
just feel
you.
Like I would feel burdened to make the person feel comfortable,
right?
Backstage, and I would just feel their awkwardness, and I would feel like I need to host them now, and I need to just because I don't want people to feel uncomfortable. So I'm still working, I'm still on, and do you feel that either one of you guys with that moment, Killian?
I think when I was younger, I would always be up for the, like, come back to the dressing room and we'll have a drink and we'll go out. But then as I got older, I just couldn't fake it, I think, any longer. But equally, I couldn't sleep. So I didn't know what to do. Like, I didn't go for a long walk, have a bath.
Because of the adrenaline, you mean, still?
Yeah. And then go to the pub. I didn't want to go to the pub. Sit alone drinking, not a good idea. So what do you, like, what do you do? I don't know what
especially
to
in the top.
I didn't know what to do.
Yeah. So. Well, can I ask you, this is another thing I'm fascinated with, and you guys, plug yours, you've heard me twat on about this before, but is it the same practice overseas there that it is apparently in New York, where if you are famous, even pseudo-famous, you are obligated, to go backstage and pay your respects and say hi. Even if the actor, even if you don't know the actor, any of the actors, and they don't know that you're there.
Yeah.
Like, is that apparent? What I've heard is that it's very rude to just watch the show and leave if you're of any sort of notoriety. Is that the same thing in over there?
Do you guys go back?
Sometimes.
My other half makes me go back.
So you'd prefer not to, but you recognize that there is a practice, there is a tradition, there's an obligation.
There is.
Yeah, there's like a little pressure. Like if they know that you're in the audience because the stage manager comes up and says, they would love to say hi. If they do that, then of course you do that.
That's just courteous. But if you don't know the person and they haven't made that connection, I think you're well within your right to just sort of
I've had people come that don't come back. I don't think anything about it.
Even if they're not in house seats or anything like that. Way for them to assume that that they're there.
I went to see Sean in previews that I didn't tell him, and I just left. I didn't even go and say hi to him.
Oh.
And it wasn't until we all went together that I went backstage. Not true.
So, Killian, it's the same thing overseas as far as the practice, the tradition?
Yeah, I mean, I can't. People do. I remember once I was doing a show in New York, and I had a night off like you have, Sean, and at the time, John Hurt was doing Crap's Last Tape, and I went to see the play, and it was unbelievable, and it was, you know, it was John Hurt. Mm-hmm. And the stage manager came up and said, would you like to go back and meet Mr. Hurt? And I went, I was doing a show at the same time, and I thought, would I like if John Hurt came back to see me? No, I wasn't comparing myself to John Hurt, but I went, you know what, I think he's probably a bit tired, I'm going to just leave. So I just left. And then afterwards I went, you fucking idiot. Why didn't you not go back and meet John Hurt? He's like one of my acting heroes.
Right.
Yeah. But I didn't because I felt he might be a little tired.
Right. And it's like, you're famous, I'm famous. So I thought I'd come back and say hi. That's the thing that sort of cringes me out about it. But but I hear that it's actually the opposite, that it's
you should bring it up more often, Jay.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Wait, I want to hear about Killian's musical career. I didn't know this about you. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah.
Well, it seems to be quite common, doesn't it? That there's a lot of frustrated musicians in acting. I've encountered lots of them. And it's initially what I'm sure there's probably some of you guys are among them, but that's all I wanted to do from the very beginning was play music. And that's when I saw you, Jason, was at the Radiohead show. And then obviously it didn't work out. And so I kind of moved into theater, I think, to try and get that live experience, you know, that connection with an audience that you get when you play music. And then I just, that just became the main thing. But it was always music, and I'm still obsessed with it, and it's still my first love.
Yeah. I didn't know that. Are you in a band? I'm sorry, forgive me.
Why would you? I don't expect you to.
He was with his brother, and what, is it true? Is the story? This is Wikipedia facts, so forgive our rigorous journalism skills. You guys had a band together, and then there was a record label that wanted you to sign, but you were like, this smells like maybe an overreach, and so let's not sign. And then things kind of transitioned into theater, and that became your passion. Was that kind of the way it went?
More or less. Like, it was, my brother was still in, he was playing keys in the band, and he was only 16 or something when we were on for the record deal. So my parents said, absolutely verboten, you're not like ruining your life. They said to me, I can ruin my life, but then we just didn't.
But Patty, we're going to protect.
It just all kind of fell apart.
Yeah.
And then I'd never been to the theater before that. And then after that, I saw a play in Cork City, where I'm from, which was
Clockwork
like
Orange.
Uh-huh. And it was a promenade version of that play. And absolutely, absolutely, like, it was the greatest thing I'd ever seen.
Had you seen the film before that?
It was banned in Ireland.
Wow.
It was banned in Ireland. The first time I saw it was I bought a VHS copy of it in Canada.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's what my grandpa's
from. We love it in Canada. We love it.
my grandfather's from Dingle. My grandmother is from County Kerry. Yeah.
Oh, man. I mean, I spent a lot of time in Dingle and around.
It's beautiful, right?
It's like my favorite place in the world.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It's beautiful.
Shawnee, have you been over there?
Yeah, just once. It's just to Ireland a couple times, but to Dingle just once. We still have cousins, like distant cousins, I think, that still live there.
Oh, man.
But yeah, it's really
pretty.
They're
going to say,
there.
I still have a sweatshirt that says, I got this.
Dingleberry.
Yeah. So the first time you really experienced the theater is when you saw Clockwork Orange on stage. Yeah, is that what you're saying? Is that what your testimony is, Julian?
Do we have your answer right?
Yeah.
Well, how did that moment go? Because your parents are both educators, yes?
Correct. Yeah.
And so this conversation of, hey, I've got good news and even better news. I'm stopping my pursuit of rock and roll, and I'm going into theater. Were they buoyed by that, or were they like, no, Killian, were they all right with it?
You mentioned I had a very short flirtation with like law.
Right.
I did like a year of a law degree, and I failed like abysmally. And then I tried to get the repeats, and then I got the repeats, and then I got a part in a play. So I think by that stage, they'd kind of gone like, whatever, just he's going to do his thing. You know, I was 20 then. So that's when you're meant to make mistakes, isn't it?
Of course.
And declare, I'm not really sure, but I'm following some instincts, and those are going to change.
Listen, Killian, I'm continuing making mistakes, and I'm 55. Right? As I said the other day, I'm firmly in the student section in life. I've finally come to that realization that I'm like, it's okay.
Well, your tan and the ceiling fan looks like you're doing all right now.
Yeah. It is. I know. It's really going. I'm sorry about that. I had to walk around and find the best place to get internet. I'm not kidding. Checking out what had the best. It's right here.
You've got a monkey on a wheel. All right. You know, this is keeping the Wi-Fi going.
But I'm curious about you getting your deciding to try to get a law degree, like that decision. And then while you're doing that, thinking the whole time, wait a second, I'd rather be doing theater. Like, I've been affected by this. I've got this thought. Is that kind of, how did that all kind of transpire?
I think I just had that natural inclination to perform, which I'm sure you guys are familiar with, you know, just from the very early age. I'm quite a shy person, but I really enjoy getting up on a stage. I hate getting up on stages myself, but I love getting up on stage as someone else or playing music.
Isn't that a weird thing where, you know, I think all four of us are, you know, proudly private people. We're not shy per se because of what we do, but like, isn't it an interesting thing where we'll sit there in front of a camera and be exposed to millions and millions of people, you know, hoping in a perfect world, millions of people are going to watch what I am doing. Mm-hmm. Yet we sort of shy away from being, you know, the center of attention often when we go out, or even when we go out to promote that thing that we want people to see. We're sort of like, I mean, I'll speak for myself. It's just like, oh, I got to go out and talk about it over here and over there and kind of light my hair on fire. It is sort of the two things are kind of at odds with one another.
Well, one's controlled and one isn't. Yeah,
that's a very good point.
That's true. That's true. What's your favorite way, Killian, to interact with fans? Like, when is it comfortable for you? I think I know what my answer would be. But
well, tell me yours. Tell me yours.
I feel if it's one-on-one, and us talking is not going to cause a larger sort of spectacle and cause a scene. Like, I don't want to embarrass myself, my kids, them, you know, so like in an elevator, if it's just me and one person and, you know, and we can have a little conversation as opposed to, oh, take a picture here. And then people walking by, look at what's going on here. Oh, maybe I should get a picture too. Oh yeah. I recognize that person. Like, and then it becomes a thing. And then, I don't know. I like sort of the one-on-one stuff. What about you?
I'm the same. I love a chat. I love you have a real chat and someone has really enjoyed something you've done.
Right.
Like, particularly, like, you know, we've all been in shows that have run a long time and people get very invested in the characters, right? And,
sure.
And so you have to acknowledge that investment and that they've spent that much time with your characters. And I love those conversations, you know? I don't like when stuff gets, like, fetishized. He's going to the shop to buy milk. Oh my God.
Yeah. He's just like us.
Right. Right.
But I love it. I love a conversation.
Right.
And we will be right back.
And now back to the show.
Are you able at times to have the same kind of experience with your characters that some of your fans might? In other words, are you able to watch what you do and enjoy it from an audience point of view, or can you not get the separation from your experience inside the character?
Oh, that's a great question, and I'd love to hear what you guys think about it.
Well, start with, like, do you watch your own stuff, or are you an actor that? Because I know both very, very good actors that watch themselves and learn from that, and then others that they can't and they won't.
Well, it's different jobs sometimes, isn't it? Like this Peaky Blinders film, like we had the premiere last night in Birmingham.
I just watched it two nights ago. It's incredible.
Incredible. I can't wait to see it.
It was very cool but I was producer on that, so I've seen the thing like 500 times. So, you know, I like... it was a very different kind of experience watching it too. You know, when you just turn up and as an actor for hire and you do your work and then you see it. And some stuff I've never seen at all, and some stuff I'm immensely proud of. But again, I feel like I try to move forward with everything. Then it's like about the next thing rather than going backwards. What about you guys? What's your take on it? Do any of you sit around watching your work endlessly?
No.
That's how I wake up every morning. I can't get out of bed without it.
That's your alarm.
But like, what about like on set? Will you ever watch a little bit of playback beginning of the production, just to get a sense of how you're coming across, how they're lighting you, little lenses, or just to get a feel of the tone of it?
Occasionally, like particularly for technical stuff, like stuff that's technical or like a stunt or whatever. But I know I would never go back and look at like big emotional stuff. But the producing thing has been interesting because it takes the curse off it a little bit. You look at it and you just go, oh my God, that's how you look. And then you just go, right. But it's important for this character to do this and this guy's got to enter here and she's got to say this and we got to cut here. And then it takes the curse off it.
Sure.
Well, you look at it through a different lens, obviously, right? So you just, like this thing that I did last year, I spent a lot of time having to watch different cuts and stuff and eventually got to a place where I got over watching myself and was actually able to watch it really objectively.
Yes.
About, wait, are we telling the best version of the story? We should go back. We should take, are we telling the best version? Is this the best take? But all these kinds of things, you know. And it did, as you say, sort of break the curse a little bit. I was no longer watching my performance. I was watching a bigger thing. I was watching
no vanity, just sort of being an audience
zero,
member.
Zero.
Yeah, I always think I'm slightly better looking than I actually am. And then I'll watch it. I'll go, nope. No, you're not. You're not at all, actually.
Turn it off.
close to being what you thought you looked like.
I know.
Killian, was there, speaking of music and then law and all this, was there ever a moment where, and thank God you didn't, but was there ever a moment where you thought, yeah, maybe this acting thing, that let's put that in the bin as well. Let's try career path number four and go into industry X or occupation Y. Did you ever think about giving up on doing this?
No, really. After a period, you kind of like, you burnt your bridges, I think, and there's nothing else available, really. Then during the fallow periods, obviously you get really cranky and like, what the fuck is that? Right. But I don't, like, I'm not a writer. I'm definitely not a writer. And so I didn't have that. But I would go and play music in the kind of fallow bits or just, you know, just go and just watch movies and read books. But I didn't know. I never got to the stage where I thought, ah, fuck this. But I did, whenever the stuff started to get kind of dry up in film or television, I was very lucky to have a friend of mine called Enda Walsh, who I made an awful lot of theater with. And we did some really great plays. He gave me my first ever play, part in a play, after I saw Clockwork Orange when I was like 19 or 20. And so I continued to work with him, making like new plays throughout my 30s and 40s. And that kind of kept me sane, I think. You know, when this stuff kind of just, people aren't calling, you know?
Yeah.
Wow, that's great. That's great. So you established like so long ago this collaboration. And you've managed to sort of keep it going for all these years.
Yeah, I haven't done a play in a while now because
it's
kind of become a little terrifying to me. Honestly, I'm a little scared.
Is it because you're worried about Jason Bateman coming backstage and saying hi for the show?
Yeah,
is that what's keeping you
Killian, away? Killian, it's me again. I've come back for one more night.
They basically got you. I want every theater to put up Jason's picture backstage and do not let this guy back here.
Super eager, will not leave.
So you start going to try to do it and they're like, no, we're good. And then really,
it's the main reason I did this podcast so that we could talk about it, actually.
Send up the warning. Is there something that you have, is there some sort of advice that you've gained with your experience now that you wish you could go back and tell that dude back then, that don't worry about the fallow periods, it's going to be, is there something that you wish you would have known then that would have made those ups and those downs a bit more tolerable?
Yeah.
This is a great question.
I mean, aside from don't worry, you're going to win an Oscar one day. Hang in there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that would definitely lighten the mood.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's that thing about overthinking stuff, overthinking it, over-intellectualizing everything and not sticking to your instinct, I think, is the key thing for artists.
I know,
the key. You
know? What is that? I know, but what is that healthy balance? Because I've always heard that with everything in life, with all of us. I think we've all heard somebody say us, you're overthinking it. But like, how do you know what the difference is between overthinking and just
inappropriate
simply,
amount of thinking?
You're just using the intelligence that you've been working on. You know, it's like we work hard to be smart, or at least we think that we're smart. And so how do you know when to pull back on that? I just don't know.
Well, what's your guys' approach to like prep then, for example? Because sometimes I would get so over, it would just take up everything and everything we're all consuming. But then the whole point when you get into a scene is that you have to be completely free of all that.
Yeah, no anger.
Right. So it's kind of counterintuitive or counterproductive to have all of that prep sometimes. But yet you think your duty is to do all of that. So what have you arrived at? It's shifted for me.
I was different from Jason because I was blown away that, and maybe you do this too, Will. Do this too, Will, is like I make sure I'm off book completely from the first time I step on set or walk out on the rehearsal room or whatever it is. Because if I have my book in my hand or whatever, I just can't be free, like you're saying, Killian, to explore and be. Where Jason has said
it's
in the past,
opposite.
Where you don't make choices, you just literally memorize the words and then you work on it in rehearsal.
But I don't even memorize the words because pardon the term, process, when I memorize, has a lot to do with my imagination of kind of how that's going to kind of go. And I don't like to decide or start to approach a decision of how I'm going to do something until I see and understand what the other actors are going to be doing and what the director is looking for and how the scene is blocked and where camera's going to be and all this stuff. Because if I predetermine how I'm going to do something and what my faces are going to look like,
and the wires,
you know, it might not work with what the other people are doing.
You've got that book of faces. I know you've got that book of Polaroids.
I've got those memorized. Yeah.
I started memorizing in really monotone ways. It's truly, I started memorizing monotone way and recording myself. This is true.
Yeah.
And with a very monotone voice so that I had zero inflection and crossing out all stage direction.
Yeah.
And just taking all of that away. Mm. And I did get into a situation, I was working on this thing and I got there and they're like, now you've got to go and get the thing on the other side of the room. I'm like, oh, do I? I didn't even know that I had it, you know, but because but actually it was very helpful because it just happened very organically and I hadn't thought about that. And so it's really shifted as I've gotten older, how I look at it. And my preparation is so much different now than it was. And also JB, I think about like when we used to do Arrested Development, for instance, it was much more, Sean, it's a TV show.
Yeah, it's a TV show. It's not, it used to be a band.
Sean's never seen it.
We got sued by them.
I used to think about sort of prepping to do comedy, especially because it was so quick and it would happen so that it didn't serve me, certainly. And I know that you were similar in this way, JB, because we did a lot of scenes together, that it was, you just kept it. It was all kind of just at the surface until you got there.
Right, so because that increases my odds of reacting to you like the audience is experiencing it.
Yeah, it's
you know?
So much about rhythm and comedy in that way.
Rhythm is the big thing, I think. The meaning can come after the rhythm, or I guess for you guys, like if the comedy or the gag or the bit, that comes out. But like if you get into a rhythm in a scene, and if you have a predetermined rhythm, then how are you going to lock in with anyone else? I guess
you can't. You can't, and you can't. You need to stay nimble to allow for shit to happen.
But I think it's different for a theater because I would be the same as you, Sean. Like with a theater piece, I would be completely off book when I get to rehearsal.
But you also and here's the difference. You also have in theater. By the time you get there, you're in you're in rehearsal. I mean, Sean, I know you, for instance, in this, and also for Goodnight Oscar. What a show! that you were completely off book. And then you get into previews, and now you've got a couple of weeks of previews,
and it changes,
and that starts to eat away at all your predetermined stuff that you have. So you don't, but you don't have that luxury when you're making a film or making a show. It's the performance is the one is that day, and that's it.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, it's funny. There is this one line where I reference a very famous musical in this current show. And one of the producers of this famous musical came to the show and didn't like that we mentioned his musical that he produced. So it's a 75-minute monologue. It's just me. Yeah. And so we had to change the one word to another musical.
Huh.
And so from the time you started, all I thought about from the time the curtain opened was that one word I had to
make
change.
Sure to get it right.
And I was like, oh, shit.
From just the time you the started.
Yeah. I was like, thanks a lot, dude.
All right. Killian, 28 days later, that was first film? No.
No, I'd done a few films in Ireland, kind of small independent films in Ireland.
This is the one that
what a
that,
film.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Put you on a lot of radars.
I guess so.
And,
yeah.
And did it feel like, okay, I've got a little bit of wind at my back now, this might work out.
Mm-hmm.
Yes or
yeah, I think so. At that stage, the film like. We never expected the film to do well, and it did well. But
you did have Danny Boyle. I mean, you knew your odds were good, right? I mean,
they were good. They were because he's a master.
Sure.
And I had like his posters of his films on my wall in my bedroom growing up. You know, before I ever became an actor, and because they were just so cool, like Trainspotting and Shallow Grave.
I love Trainspotting.
And
Shallow Grave.
I mean, it's a masterpiece. And but the thing about it was that zombie genre wasn't very cool at the time, or wasn't really like there hadn't been a kind of a zombie thing.
Right.
And even though this is technically like an infection, they're not undead. But anyway, at that time that we shot it, like it was the summer of 2001, and then obviously like 9/11 happened, and then but before that SARS had happened, and then. And then obviously all those years later, like COVID happened, and then it became this kind of meme. And it's a very prescient writing, very good writing.
Yeah.
And people went nuts for it, the original movie. So, yeah, it was a great start. But I went through the ringer for that movie. Like, Danny, I had like 5 or 6 auditions for that to get the part. I'd done very little at the time. And
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I kind of knew it was a real substantial script. But Alex Garland wrote the script and Danny directed it. And
great writer.
Yeah.
He was such a great writer and an amazing director.
Amazing director. What was the moment from your last audition? When did you find out that you got it after going through all the auditions and being like, Jesus Christ.
You remember that moment? You remember where you were?
I do actually. I was in Stansted Airport in the queue to get a Ryanair flight back to Dublin, and Danny called me. And I had to do one of those like unbelievably contained celebrations where you like drop my bag and sit down and kind of it was massive for me. That movie. It's fucking 23 years ago or something.
Wow. Now he talks often, doesn't he, about energy over perfection? Do I have that
Danny.
Right? His sort of his MO on set. Can you explain what he might mean by that? What his direction, his environment is like, what that set is like, what his style is like?
Sounds about right. Yeah, he's incredible energy and passion for it. Like, he never stops moving. He never stops. Like, he's on every single element of the set, and it's constant ideas. Constant. He's constantly pushing, you know, and really pushing the actors and pushing every department, I absolutely loved that at that age. I don't think I'd been in, you know, working with someone who was so coherent in their vision for the film, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, sure. Just full enthusiasm and just knows all four corners of what this scene's supposed to do and how it's supposed to be done. Yeah.
And it's infectious. And every time you think, oh, that was pretty good, like, you know, you're off again. And we shot that on domestic cameras, like these little, do you remember in the early 2000s, everyone had these little cameras with like cards in them and stuff. So they were all like stuff you could buy. And so that,
like that's camcorders almost.
Yeah, they were slightly more advanced. I can't remember what the format is. But anyway, it was just one of those movies that kind of clicked, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's okay.
A style that I would imagine is it wildly different than, you know, what an incredible collaboration you've had with Christopher Nolan.
I was going to get
to projects,
incredible.
Right?
Incredible.
That from what I understand, what I've heard is a more exacting and contained and deliberate approach to the execution, yes or no, and you know, to the extent you're comfortable talking about it, because I would assume that you know, environments on sets, well, not assume, I know, they're often private, you know, individual environments that are weird to re-describe, but it just strikes me, having not many actors get to work with the same director, six different projects. I'd imagine you guys have a bit of a shorthand and a real comfort in each other's style.
Oh yeah, I mean, I've learned so much from Chris. He's completely kind of shaped my whole career. I mean, it's very clear, like working over 20 years. But he's absolutely remarkable. He is incredibly rigorous, incredibly precise, but within that, there's fantastic freedom.
Yeah.
You know, there's only one camera, and there's Chris, and he's got this tiny little monitor that he has, like, puts back.
Never two
back.
Cameras.
Rarely, unless there's a big set piece, you know.
Yeah.
But he has this tiny little thing, again, from, like, the 90s, that he watches this shitty little playback from the thing. But he rarely is watching it, because he's right beside the camera watching you. And you'll never leave it. He'll never leave a scene unless he feels like, you know, you're happy and he's happy. And I can't really explain how wonderful it is, how focused it is, how fast it is, but yet it never feels fast. Mm-hmm. Like, we shot Oppenheimer in 59 days or something like that.
Wow. With all that
bonkers
scope.
That's, I know.
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing.
So do you think that speed or that efficiency, it just comes as a result of him really being precise about knowing what he wants, what he needs? He's properly prepared, and he doesn't hang around longer than he's gotten what he wants for that particular shot, and off we go.
Exactly. I mean, he's written the thing, and he knows every single frame. He storyboarded it all in his head. Mm. So it's, and the thing about Nolan movies is, when they used to be DVDs, there was never any extras, because he shoots the script. Right, the script is the script. There's no deleted scenes. There's no extra. It's the script. And he finishes every movie like ahead of schedule on the budget.
Yeah.
Do you feel having him? Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. Having him right next to camera, and obviously you guys, because you've worked so much together, there is a comfort there. Do you get a comfort of having? Do you feel that comfort of having him right there next to camera, close to you?
Yeah. There's no such thing as video village or like monitors or
it's
anything.
Like when I stand next to you, Will.
You just comfort.
You can see
comfort.
Will's,
no,
Will's shoulders just drop.
No, we're talking about comfort. But I mean, so then I'm going to ask you. So you feel that, and you must. That's it's evident in your work that you do with him, and so I wonder if when you go and you do work with other directors, do you ever feel that like sort of sense of not detachment, but sometimes if it is further, they are further away, or they are at Video Village, or you're not, and you don't have that sort of that proximity, that relationship that's so close. Do you feel the difference sometimes? And I don't mean this as to disparage other directors, clearly.
Sure. No, I understand. No, I think it's like what we were discussing earlier. You know, I think it's our duty to be really, really flexible, isn't it? Because if you come on one set with us, and like, this is the only way I will work.
Sure.
But some directors love to rehearse. Some directors don't love to rehearse. Some directors love have everybody look at the monitor and chat, and others, you know, don't do that. So you have to kind of bend to their approach, I find. And I love doing that. Like, and you know, I don't particularly love rehearsal on film, but if there's a director that insists on it, I'll go for it, you know, it's their vision and I'm just there to serve the vision. And so I kind of like that, the adventure of it. And I'm sure you guys are all the same. You know, it's like it's always like a new circus, isn't it? Every time you get a new job, it's like this new circus, and what's it going to involve? Yeah. And what are the, what, you know? So I like that.
For sure.
We'll be right back.
And back to the show.
How do you like affecting the health of that circus, the harmony of that environment, depending on your level of influence on that set? Like, you know, just even the Nolan films, for example, that there are some where you're a part of an ensemble, and then like Oppenheimer, you're the lead, and you can affect the environment. Peaky Blinders, again, sort of the captain, and also in a producerial position as well. Do you enjoy that sort of leadership position, or do you like to disappear into just be sort of part of the team and be like a soldier?
I think it's a bit of both, really, isn't it? It's funny you say soldier, because the whole of the film set is based off like the old military kind of setup, isn't it? Like with your director and your first AD and your second AD and your third AD, and you know, everyone's got number one on the call sheet, number two on the call, you know, and it has to work like that, and you know, and everything comes from the top. I think, you know, the atmosphere and the ambience and the vibe and the energy always is percolates down from the leaders, like the producers and the director and the lead actors down to how everyone. So I think it's always nice to. I love to have a set where people are having a bit of fun and a bit of crack and crack in the Irish vernacular.
Yeah, for sure. We were with you.
Okay, I could.
Oh boy,
I want to know how
Murphy loves crack.
We've got our yep.
Killian, how do you speaking about healthy? How do you stay so fit? You're always like you're. I know you're younger than us, but
I think it's crack. Is it not? He just told us.
Because you have kids too, right? You're constantly working. You're constantly on the go. But you're in like incredible shape.
Will looks pretty good there. He
does. Oh, thanks, man.
That's bronzer. A lot of that's bronzer.
Yeah, it is. I just sprayed it on.
I think all of you guys are very well maintained. I think it's kind of the part of the job, isn't it? Unfortunately, or fortunately, right. I don't know.
Well, there's another part of that Wikipedia incredible hints I got. There was, is it true that you, To avoid mad cow disease, you went vegetarian. Then you started eating meat to bulk up for Peaky Blinders, and then you stopped eating meat, and you're back to vegetarian. It didn't give me the reason for the return. But do they have it right so far?
That's more or less accurate. I met my wife when I was 20, and she's been a vegetarian all her life. So I was kind of became a vegetarian then, and then. I did kind of, so it was more out of convenience than of any real sort of, you know, opposition to it. But now I do it because I don't really want to eat animals or, you know.
And if you were to, you would make ends meet.
Thank you, Will. And that's our episode, everybody. Thank you for joining us.
Wonderful book.
We have made the two pieces of string connect at the bottom. No, but you know, that whole bulking up thing, and I'm all over the place, but I saw this documentary once because I went vegetarian for a year to try to lower my cholesterol, and it only dropped 1 point after 12 months of eating nothing but sticks and berries. Yeah,
wasn't that long ago.
But I watched this documentary while I was doing it, and they made a point that you don't need meat to bulk up because they made a point that like gorillas are vegetarians. Rhinoceros, giraffe, like all these huge animals, all they eat are leaves. And
you're absolutely right there. The update is that I am now like I've always been pescatarian and I don't eat any meat. So that's the Wikipedia update.
So fish.
We'll
fish
add that
now?
In there today.
Thanks.
You say you do the fish.
I do the fish. Yes.
Right. Right, yeah.
And you're entirely right. It's very possible to if you need to do that to do it through plant protein, of course.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I was just being an idiot back then.
I'm still an idiot. All right, let's talk to me about Peaky Blinders now.
How long had you been doing? How long did you? Sorry, Jay. How long did you do Peaky Blinders before How long have you been living in the world of Peaky Blinders?
So we did the show on and off for since we shot the first season in the end of 2012. So on and off.
Wow. Yeah. So, 14 years?
So which I worked out was like a quarter of my life.
And how have you, I'm sure you have enjoyed, because you could have left it earlier, but you have undoubtedly enjoyed the progression of Tommy and shaping his growth along with Stephen Knight. Yes.
Yes, but I'm curious to know about you guys as well, because people ask me this stuff, and you know that old showbiz adage, like, you know, don't quit a hit. Like, so mm-hmm. when,
yeah.
like,
amen.
Like, if something is working, and people, you know, a lot of journalists will say, oh, it must be, you know, hard going back playing the same. It's amazing writing.
Well, if it's incredibly high quality, like what you guys have there, and the film, my God, took it to even a higher level of production value and cinematic pleasures. Just unbelievably well directed and shot and scored and performed and lit. I mean, what a film. But yes, amen. If you've got a gig in this business, stick with it. These people
stick
that like
with it,
quit their quit their series job because they want to be open for all the feature opportunities that they feel might be just around the corner. It's like, no, ding dong.
Yeah.
You got time for those too.
I love that character of yours. The guy who talks like this, who does the thing that
it's I want to be favorite. Freed up for features. Like, give me.
Yeah, exactly.
But also, exactly. I think the thing that those people forget is that the features people are all watching the show.
Right.
Yeah. And thinking,
Right.
Of course.
Right.
Yeah. You know, wouldn't they be great in my film? You know?
Yeah. Right.
Killian, do you spend a lot of time in the States, or are you happy where you are?
I do come over for work, yeah. I haven't lived other than, you know, for jobs.
You love Ireland?
Well, I lived in London for a long time we lived here for 14 years. And
You live in London now. I'm sorry.
We're back in Ireland now for about 10 years, but we did live in London for 14.
Oh, got it.
And then before that, we were kind of like, you know, wherever work would take me, I guess.
Yeah, why do you ask, Sean? Do you have a Airbnb?
You got a rental that you were just pay off the mortgage just to cover cost, right? And what can you offer him? Housekeeper comes twice a week? Yeah.
Did the occupant just take off?
I just think first and last and a deposit. We're good. I don't know. I'm always curious because I love it where you are, and I get the draw to both. I mean, America is obviously incredible.
But we're kind of like itinerant, aren't we? We just have to follow the work, and that's the nature of it. And
yeah, we're in the circus, as you say.
My friend once called it the circus of the unemployable. I know that was a very good phrase.
Yeah, that is.
The thing I was going to ask you about doing multiple seasons, years of the same character is how much have you enjoyed having that character grow with you, because of you, has Killian grown through what you've been experimenting with Tommy? I mean, I'm sure there's a yes to all of this. So I'm not positive what the question is, which is a habit of mine.
I know what you mean. No, I think it's a good question, and honestly, I don't really have a really good answer though, because we just finished it, and it's just coming out, and I think I need a little bit of distance to reflect. I think it's what my initial kind of response to it is that it was a massive gift to be able to tap that vein of writing and for it to stay that good, mm-hmm. and for it to, because it was this little show on BBC Two on a Sunday night that, you know, no one had any expectations for it. It had no promotion or anything like that. And it was genuinely made by fans on the internet telling each other to watch it.
Yeah.
And then it just grew and grew. One of those kind of beautiful kind of freaks that happen sometimes in our business where people just love it. And then the show gets confidence and, you know.
Yeah, it's because, mm-hmm. I would think it was because it took such a distinct point of view. There you weren't sort of pandering to a huge audience, you know. You were sort of like, we're going to make the show that we really like. We're going to put the, we're going to shoot it the way we want to shoot it. We're going to put this music in there that we really love. And hopefully enough people like it to just keep us on the air, but we're not looking to be some massive hit. And that type of specificity and commitment actually yielded a real fervent fan base. Yeah.
Well, as opposed to sort of trying to retrofit, trying to go like, we want to make a show that hits all this audience. And so how can we, and that's a recipe for disaster. I wonder, Killian, were there moments during various seasons of the show and certainly before the film, like were there moments you're like, this is it, this is the last one, and then it happened again? Like, did you ever have those, like, where you felt like, or was it always open-ended, like, we're going to do more?
Well, we only got one series, and then we were hoping we'd get recommissioned, you know. Mm-hmm. I think we did maybe 4 and 5 one after the other. I can't really recall, but Steve always had it in his head. So the series begins at the end of World War One, and he always had it in his head that it would end at the opening, or sort of the beginning of World War Two, and he's achieved that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that was such a, like, no one had, like, there's lots and lots of films about the First World War, and many, many, many films about the Second World War, but not so many films or TV shows that deal with Britain between the wars. Which mm-hmm. So that's where he said it, and in Birmingham, which is like the second city in the UK, and has its very own specific and unique history. And so, I think because, like you say, it didn't have these ambitions to be this huge show, but yet it, because it was so unique, that people came to it. I don't know. I just don't know why.
Yeah. Well, if we all knew it made a hit, everything would be a hit.
You are such a classy fella. I'm sure you'd be very hesitant to take any credit. But I would guess that you can take some credit, perhaps, for the incredibly beautifully bold move of the music.
Haircut?
the music throughout the show, is that something that, I mean, given your music background, your current musical taste, I mean, it's just such a... It's such an exciting sort of juxtaposition, and this modern fucking punk rock throughout something that is set in, you know, World War One. It's just great.
It was a bit of a big swing at the time, and Otto Bathurst directed the first three series, and he put that Nick Cave tune, that Red Right Hand, right at the beginning of the, and it was incredibly anachronistic, and it shouldn't have worked, but for some reason it did, and then we were kind of off, and then all these artists throughout it, like PJ Harvey and like
Radiohead.
David Bowie, Radiohead, and like everybody started, you know, wanting to have their music on the show and giving us original music, and it was it's been kind of remarkable. Absolute privilege for a music nerd like me, you know.
Yeah,
what a treat.
I love that.
All right, well, I'm assuming you've answered this question a million times, but we're putting Peaky Blinders to bed. I will ask you, I'm sure you're going to take a big part of him with you. You going to miss him? Are you going to miss playing that character? It's just been, you've just done so much work in that skin.
I suppose I probably will.
Yeah.
I don't think about it. What do you guys feel about those long-running shows and those characters? I'm curious to know.
Just turn
you...
the page, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But do you actually feel, I mean, are you extremely unsentimental, or do you have a great affection for them?
My personal either limits or strategy or style or whatever is to find that character inside of me. You know, it's usually way over on one side or the other of what my goalposts are, you know, the limits of who I am. So that person's always inside of me. So I'll always carry that character with me a bit. Mm-hmm. I feel like if it's outside my goalposts, then I get into acting. So I got to find, you know, there would be a version of him inside me somewhere. What about you two fellas?
Yeah, I'm proud and excited that the fans love the character I played for so many years. But for me personally, like Jason just said, ready to move on.
Turn it.
After that. Yeah,
I'm not sentimental in that way.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Neither am I. Yeah.
You're happy to say kind of goodbye. Nice knowing you. Next.
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah, mm-hmm. And very proud of it. And like you say, like really proud that it had such an impact and that the people invested so much. But you have to have a forward momentum.
It's more for me. Usually, it's the people I've worked with doing it. That it's really tragic that we have to get used to saying goodbye to.
Right.
That's an odd muscle that we all unfortunately have to strengthen is saying goodbye to these families that we're constantly creating on sets.
That's the strange thing. Yeah.
You know, when you run into someone, I was just thinking about you run into people that you worked with on something really intensely, and you see them like at a restaurant or out in the street or at something else, you know. And it's I don't even just mean actors, like anybody who's part of the filmmaking process, production designer or whomever, and you see them, you're like, and you go,
what the hell are you doing?
Hey, and you've got this like really intense part of your life where you had this real connect, where you were both doing this creative endeavor. You're like, hey, but you've always got that. You know what I mean?
Yes. And your family has no idea who these people are. You've spent more time with them in the last few years than you have your actual family. And they've never met them.
And they bring you such joy in that moment when you see them.
And then it's instant. There's no like getting to know you again. Right. It's just you're straight back into it because you've been through the trenches.
Strange. Yeah. We are two minutes over. Parting shot, Shawnee?
No, I was just going to say, now when I run into you, Killian, we worked on this together.
We did.
We have this moment and this experience together. So when we run into each other,
Peaky
we'll
Blinders,
it.
The Immortal Man, in select theaters, it already March 6th, it was, and on Netflix March 20th. I highly recommend this thing. And you can't fold laundry watching it either. Put the laundry down, tuck in, and enjoy every frame of this thing. Incredible work done by in front of and behind the cameras. It's a stunning film. Really.
You're very kind. It's lovely to chat to you guys. I had loads of questions to ask you guys.
Let's start. People
ask. Get yourself a podcast and invite us on. They're handing them out.
Thank you.
We haven't had a gossip.
We gossip all day long.
Yeah.
Well, you can gossip after I leave.
Yeah. Yeah. Such a pleasure to meet you.
What a pleasure.
Been a big fan for a long,
such
long time.
Such a big fan. Yeah, same. Such a big fan. Man.
Likewise, guys.
Yeah. You're the man, Killian.
Lovely to chat to you all. And we'll do it again.
You too. Enjoy your evening. Get your slippers on.
Thanks.
All right.
Bye. See you guys. Bye. It's nearly bedtime now.
All right. Bye, buddy.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, there he is. And you know, the most remarkable thing about his talent, that accent, completely fake. He is actually from...
No kidding.
Canton, Ohio.
Why would he?
Yeah, his dad actually was one of the people that helped build the NFL Hall of Fame.
That's amazing.
Amazing. No, this is a character he hasn't dropped for years.
Incredible. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that's deep.
That is amazing.
Deep.
So, wow. That's
what
like
a fella. Huh?
You know what?
He's so good.
Christopher Nolan and him, like you kind of think of those two together. And I was trying to think of like, who else there. There's a lot of them, like Tim Burton and Johnny Depp.
Leonardo DiCaprio and Scorsese. And Martin Scorsese now.
Sure.
Yeah.
De Niro and Scorsese.
Yeah, and Tom Hanks and Spielberg did a bunch, didn't they?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He's one of them.
Here comes a joke, right? Let's see. Sean
Hayes,
I
thought that was leading to a bye, but no, that was a real observation.
It was. He was being sincere while he searches for a bye. Where do you go? Is there a bye website?
Do have a bunch of bye things, but
boy, you're showing a lot of restraint, not doing any of the bye jokes at all.
That's a good
one. Sean, did you key in on one?
Did you get
I did.
One?
This just came to me. I hope, the movie, I can't wait to see the movie of our guest today.
That's great.
It's called Peaky Binders.
Beautiful, Sean.
Smart. Less. Smart. Less.
Smartless is 100% organic and artisanally handcrafted by Bennett Barbaco, Michael Grant Terry, and Rob Armjarf.
Smartless.